Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Agyan Tamiranjasa Jananjana Sarakya Chakshara Meditanyana Tashma Shri Guruve Namaha. So, this text, coupled with other texts, is describing the nature of the transformation of false ego, ahamkara, in passion, rajas. As we heard in the previous verse, that the functions of intelligence are to help in ascertaining the nature of objects when they come into view and to help the senses. So this intelligence is intimately connected with the various senses of the body. And therefore, it is under the influence of ahankara, false ego, in passion or rajas, which is, you know, that's an interesting situation, because mosquitoes. In the Bhagavad Gita, we hear that the intelligence is considered to be higher than the mind. And previously we heard that the mind is a transformation of ahankara in goodness. So, although intelligence is connected with rajas, which in one sense is considered a lower mode or a further covering, a deeper covering of the modes of material nature, still intelligence is considered to be higher and more subtle than the mind. And it is because of its function in relationship to the senses, and the senses are more connected with activity, which is the symptom of rajas or passion. So, to give an example, astrologically, there are certain planets which are considered harmful, just like Mars and Saturn, and they are ruled by a tamasic, they are considered tamasic by nature. So they are, in one sense, lower planets than other planets, which may be more sattvic in an astrological chart like Jupiter. Yet, according to the rising sign at the time of one's birth, planets rule certain houses. So if a harmful planet, such as Mars, rules a beneficial house, then in the chart it becomes a functional benefic planet. And actually, so although its nature is malefic, but in this case, it functions as a very beneficial, helpful planet, even influencing activities in goodness. And another example, I guess, you see that some people have a strong tendency towards violence. It is something that they're attracted to, which is generally considered a tamasic quality. Yet, if such as Arjuna, Arjun function as a devotee of Krishna, and therefore, because of his function in relationship to Krishna, that ability for violence actually became something beneficial and even liberating to others. So it is the functional nature, how something functions, ultimately becomes the higher principle of how we characterize that particular nature of that thing. So in this case here, although intelligence is ruled by rajas, which is a lower quality than sattva, it depends how intelligence functions, and it is supposed to function as the controller of the mind and the senses, and when it does that, then it actually achieves its higher nature, which it is capable of, and therefore, as it describes here, that it is through intelligence that one can, you know, attain that sattvic knowledge of understanding the difference between the body and the soul. So that knowledge is sattvic, and yet it is attained by intelligence, which is under the influence of rajas. See? So it, but when it functions properly, it produces a sattvic effect. But because it's so intimately related with the senses, therefore, you know, by nature, it is a manifestation of ahankara in rajas. Any comments on that part before I just move on? So then here, these different aspects of intelligence are further described. And of course, you know, we are very fortunate to have such clear knowledge of the functions of the mind and the intelligence and the senses and the ego, the false ego. So much research and, you know, philosophical research experimental knowledge has been done in order to try and understand these different aspects, and also how they relate to the brain or the heart, generally it is a very misunderstood science, and the psychologists and you know, those who study the brain and what have you, they have very limited knowledge of this. But here in Srimad Bhagavatam, very, very clear, very clear understanding. So, and we have that nice example, which is, you have that picture in the Bhagavad Gita, where you have the five horses representing the five senses. You have the reins, which are controlling, you know, making the horses go this way and go that way, representing the mind. You have the driver, representing the intelligence. Okay, so in that sense, again, you see that the intelligence is controlling the mind, controlling the senses. So therefore, although the intelligence is connected through the senses, it does so also through the mind, which is, in one sense, the sixth sense. And sitting next to the driver is the soul, who is sometimes asleep. So when the soul is awake, you know, the soul is actually should be dictating that, you know, take me to this direction, you know, avoid, don't take me over this cliff today. Like that. So the soul is, through that Krishna consciousness, is getting clear vision of what is correct, what is not correct, and you know, the intelligence is the next door neighbour, as Srila Prabhupada says. to the soul, and then controlling the mind and the senses. A very clear understanding of how all of those work. Then, intelligence here has further aspects to it. Beginning from doubt. Srila Prabhupada mentions here that in the purport he says, to study, the study to determine whether one's identity is spiritual or material begins in doubt. So doubt is helpful. That in the beginning, when there is, one questions something, why? What is this? Why is that doing like that? That doubt is actually the symptom of intelligence in the immature stage. That questioning. It's like Srila Prabhupada says, little boys or little girls, when they're very mischievous, he says that's the symptom of good intelligence. Yeah. And he gives the example that, whether he's seen this happen or I don't know, maybe he did it himself, but that sometimes a little boy may think when they hear the madanga, someone is, tapping the ends, and of course you're getting this big sound coming out. And Prabhupada says, so the little boy may think that someone is inside there, banging very loudly like that. So they may pick up the madanga and try and break it so they can see, what is inside, who is inside, like that. See? So there's some, some doubt, some questioning, what is that? I don't understand. Is there something inside there? So, that doubt. So, quite often, to the dismay of many parents, that mischievous quality can often be stifled. But one should see it. This child, their intelligence is developing. Also, often when I sit down to do a ceremony at someone's home, quite often the little children will come and they'll ask me a million questions. What's that? Why did you put that there? What are you doing with that coconut? Why did you put water in that pot? Like that. And the parents are going, be quiet, be quiet. Go and sit over there. And I'm saying, no, it's okay. I don't mind like that. And they're going, no. You go over, leave Pundit. He's busy. He's trying like that. Okay. It's their intelligence is kicking in. And from that doubt, that is the beginning of then trying to understand with their intelligence, the correct nature of things like that. Doubt is a good thing, and young devotees also, they ask a lot of questions, which is good. Of course, some questions can't be answered straight away, but we have to be careful not to make devotees or new people feel embarrassed about asking too many questions, or even about asking questions which may be above their level of understanding. So they have to encourage that inquisitiveness. So that is the beginning. And as Prabhupada says here, that doubting is one of the important functions of intelligence. Blind acceptance of something does not give evidence of intelligence. So, therefore, one of the there are four principles upon which this movement is based upon, which are mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Humility, which is personified by Sanatana Goswami. There is tolerance, personified by... Who is tolerance personified by? I would like to hazard an educated guess. Who would personify tolerance? Harry Listicle, yeah. And renunciation, who personifies renunciation? What's that? You would think so, wouldn't you? It's Ramananda Rai, Grihastha. And mine usually goes to the sannyasis, and yeah, Ramananda Rai. And criticism, the fourth pillar of Krishna consciousness movement, constructive criticism. You know, to doubt something, to question something critically, constructively. Not to accept something blindly, to question. Is that correct? Is that authorized, Prabhu? And personified by Swarup Damodara, who is none other than Lalita Shakti, and the personal secretary to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So no one can criticize the personification of criticism because he is so intimately connected with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But he would, anything that was presented in the way of devotional service to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was critically, constructively and critically analysed by Swarup Damodara as to whether it could be offered. And if he found some faults in that the bhakti element was not correct or it wasn't authorised by our previous charas, then it would be rejected. He would mention that this has to be corrected, you can correct this and then you can, you know, re-present. And then we can offer to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu like that. just like when we're doing an offering of foods, you know, the brahmanas, they, you know, analytically, you know, and critically examine what is being cooked, who is cooking, what are the clothes that the cooks are wearing, what is their consciousness while they're cooking, who is offering, how it is being offered, when it is being offered, what are the standards of cleanliness, what are the standards of cleanliness in the kitchen, everything like that. There was one devotee in the past times of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I think an offering had been made, and then as a bhajari came in, he touched the top of the door, and that offering was rejected because the senior devotee considered that when you touch, someone may have touched that part of the door and therefore you've become Muchi and the whole offering has to be rejected and done again. Very, very strict. But so that criticism, constructive, in order to make things correct and follow exactly the principles of Srila Prabhupada, the mood of Srila Prabhupada, that is done by every devotee. Every devotee practices criticism, renunciation, tolerance and humility. That is done by every devotee. But we have leaders who show us how to do it properly, such as Swarup Damodara, Ramananda Raya, and Haridas Thakur and Sanatana Goswami. So, therefore, you know, doubt is one of the important functions of intelligence. So intelligence means that we are properly ascertaining the nature of something. doubt, critical, you know, constructive, critical, you know, is this correct? That sort of critical movement. Is that correct? Has that been done properly? Like that doubt. It's an important part of function. If we just said, oh, so-and-so has done this particular thing, this was done by a devotee, therefore everything's correct. You know, a little doubt, okay. You know, no, but let's check. Let's see the checks and balances like that. So now Prabhupada mentions a little further that in order to cultivate intelligence, one should be doubtful in the beginning. Of course, you know, that can be applied in two ways. One, in the beginning of developing one's intelligence, and also in the beginning of doing anything. I mean, it's not that, as we say, that doubting principle just disappears, you know, after the beginning. Even as we described, even a mature devotee still, you know, will doubt or question whether something has been done properly. That's a doubt. Has this been done properly? That's a doubt. That's done even by mature devotees. Not that only neophytes have doubts and then senior devotees can't have doubts, because Prabhupada says it only happened at the beginning. The beginning means, you know, the beginning of any particular event also, even for mature devotee, they're doubting, has something been done. So, but doubting is not very favourable when information is received from the proper source. So once, you know, the authorities have approved something, we should be very careful to doubt what an approved authority is saying. So, you know, in the case with Sri Damodar, you know, someone has, forget the name of the devotee, they offered a commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam, and that was not accepted by Sri Damodar. Now, if one doubts the authority of Sri Damodar, even after hearing from him, then that's, as Prabhupada says, in Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that doubting the words of the authority is the cause of destruction, then that's very dangerous. And doubting the words of Srila Prabhupada. We had an interesting discussion in Bhakti Vaibhava last Saturday. We were discussing, you know, some of the comments of Srila Prabhupada, you know, about the nature of men and women generally. And of course, that always leads to quite an interesting conversation. But what was really fascinating to me was that you know, one of the devotees mentioned that some people sort of doubt Prabhupada's view on the nature of men and women like that. That really surprised me, you know, considering that you can't doubt Prabhupada, that, you know, you can have doubts, why is Prabhupada saying that? Let me try and understand. That seems to be something incorrect. You can have that doubt, but you can't doubt that Prabhupada is wrong. Just like Krishna says, you know, I am the taste of water. So Prabhupada says, you know, you can have that doubt, how is Krishna the taste of water? But you can't doubt Krishna that he is the taste of water. You see, there's a difference. Is a big difference. So doubt is there, it has its place, but it has to be properly used. And when it's properly used, good intelligence will be there. When doubt is improperly used, it will be destructive even for a devotee. So ultimately, by this, as Prabhupada goes on in his purport, so that is the first one, doubt, which is one of the principles of good intelligence. misapprehension. When one is able to analyze his actual position, the false identification with the body is detected. This is viparyasya. So when we detect that there is a false apprehension, that's good intelligence. That we've detected, if we detect that I have been acting in such a way as if I am the material body, but I'm understanding that the authorities and good reasoning and the scriptures are describing that I'm not the body, and personal experience shows that when I cater to the soul, there is happiness, and when you cater to the body, there is just all sorts of misery. So, determining that misapprehension that I am the body, that is also a facet of intelligence. Then the next step would be to understand what is the correct identification. Ultimately, intelligence, this is, as Prabhupada says here, in the previous purport, actually, Prabhupada says that perfection of intelligence is attained when one becomes fixed in the activities of Krishna consciousness. By the proper use of intelligence, one's consciousness is expanded, and the ultimate expansion of consciousness is Krishna consciousness. So one comes to understand that we are the spirit soul, and that that spirit soul is the eternal servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who constitutes the absolute truth or the complete whole. So then here, Srila Prabhupada, explaining the text, describes smriti means memory, and svapa means sleep. He says, sleep is also necessary to keep the intelligence in working order. If there is no sleep, the brain cannot work nicely. In Bhagavad Gita, it is especially mentioned that persons who regulate eating, sleeping, and other necessities of the body in the proper proportion become very successful in the yoga process. So, this is a really interesting point here that, the other day my mother said to me, she said, I think you're very intelligent. And I said, actually, I'm not so intelligent. I've always considered that I just have, reasonable, moderate. I didn't go into a whole discussion, but reflecting on this, the difference is that as devotees, we lead a life which is very conducive to good intelligence. That's the difference. Meaning that even if our intelligence, from a material perspective, is low or moderate, not particularly high, the lifestyle of Krishna consciousness will produce the highest intelligence. In fact, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes that this Krishna consciousness movement is meant for the most intelligent persons. And by following the process of Krishna consciousness, one becomes the most intelligent person. Here, sleep is one of the aspects which is intimately connected with intelligence. So usually we think of sleep, and we think of sleep as, again, an aspect of tamaguna. But, as we described, but when sleep functions properly, it actually supports intelligence which supports the highest realizations in sattva guna, even transcendence. Because, you know, when it functions properly. So, you know, sometimes, I remember, you know, especially in the early days, there were some devotees who really struggled with, you know, the amount of sleep they were getting. It was just too little. And I've told the story sometimes, I think in Bhaktivedanta, I'll tell it here as well, but, you know, the one godbrother of mine, we were in Adelaide back in the early 80s, and we, you know, Sankirtan devotees, and he had, you know, he had a lot of trouble. You know, he used to complain to the authorities and various personalities, but there was really, you know, in those days, you sort of, everyone was put in one particular slot. You slept a certain time, you followed everyone else, and there was no exceptions, no leeways, no, you know, compromises. He was really struggling, and sometimes people who are really struggling for some reason, I don't know, but they used to give them to me as my partner. Anyway, one time I went to, you know, went to find him. I used to try and find him in the morning, and usually he would go and get some extra sleep. Now, the general consensus in those days, and probably still today, I'm not sure, was that, you know, if a devotee chanted their rounds, which he used to do, went to Mangalayati, went to class and had prasadam and then slept, they'd basically taken away all the benefit of coming to sattva guna, and then they go back into tamva guna, and therefore they've wasted all that morning program like that. That was the mood. So, but he used to have to get this sleep, and I used to have to go and find him. And one time, I looked everywhere in the temple, I looked in all the cars, and I couldn't find him. But I knew he was somewhere sleeping. And I thought to myself, there's only one place I didn't check thoroughly. And that is, this is in Adelaide, it was at Frome Street. There's a temple, you know, nice big building, old building, right in the middle of the city. And, you know, downstairs, so there was a basement area, all concrete, no windows, very dark. And they had the washing machines and that in there. and in the corner, just a big pile of old clothes and rags that, you know, just seemed to sit there forever. And I thought, I didn't look under all those dirty clothes, because you'd think, who's going to sleep, you know, under all, you know, because it was a bit damp and it was a bit wet and, you know, it was, and I thought, I'll go and have a look. Pulling up all the clothes and the rags, and there he is, you know, sleeping under there. So, you know, to such lengths he had to go to, when I look back now, you know, he went to such lengths, you know, because he really needed that extra sleep. As an interesting comment, if you look at the eightfold Ashtakalya Leela of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after he, you know, he rises in the morning, and he, you know, different servants come and help him to, you know, wash his face and feet and freshen him. And then he'll go and spend some time with, you know, Mother Yashoda and he, you know, his father. And then, you know, at about sunrise, he'll go down to the bank of the Ganges and take a bath and, you know, put on some nice clothes. And they come home, and they'll worship the deity, the family deity, and do the puja and the kirtan, and then they honour the prasadam, and then he goes to sleep. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And that is his time to have a sleep. Yeah. Straight after breakfast. So, to me, that, you know, it sort of dispels the myth that if a devotee takes a little nap after breakfast, it's not that they've wasted their morning program. And some devotees actually need that. Prabhupada used to take a rest just after lunch. And, you know, I know in India that was a very common thing. It used to always fascinate me when I went to India in 1980, 82 and 84. Haven't been since then. But, if you went down to the shops to buy some cloth or what have you, everything's shut, you know, just after lunch. Everyone's shut, they all go to sleep. You know, imagine going down Chapel Street, you know, just after lunch. They've all closed up. What's that? Oh, we're all asleep. Come back in an hour or two. So, the Prabhupada also used to take about an hour's rest just after, lunch. So, that sleep, sometimes just after, a full morning program, if a devotee feels that you've got a whole day to get ahead of you, a little sleep, a power nap, is going to help your intelligence function really well. And if you go through the day and that sleep is not there, unless you're an avaduta, even Prabhupada slept, but we must admit, even with that sleep after lunch, he was still averaging about 3 or 4 hours a day and travelling, all over the world. So, it wasn't really much. But still, even on his level, he was showing us the example. A little sleep, You've got the rest of the evening or the rest of the day, especially if you're driving, studying, doing accounting, you don't want to get your figures wrong, or dealing with people, and you've got to be in a happy, nice frame of mind like that. A little sleep maintains a good intelligence like that. And also, as mentioned here, the other habits, not eating too much. Because if we eat too much, then we'll sleep too much. Or if we, not regulated in our eating and sleeping, then, these things will affect our intelligence. So it comes back to some really basic principles. And as Krishna says in the Gita, that one who eats too much, sleeps too much or too little, eats too much or sleeps or too little, sleeps too much or too little, all these different things, it's very difficult for them on the yoga path. One should be moderate. Moderate means that, and each individual devotee, because, we have a standard, generally devotees sleep about 6 hours a day. On top of that, they may get an extra hour or two according to their requirements here and there in order to, maintain that good intelligence. And if they maintain that good intelligence and Krishna consciousness, that sleep is a good thing. It is not maya. Good intelligence means you become Krishna conscious. Like that. And when the intelligence starts to fail, as described here, memory starts to fail. One of the symptoms that intelligence is slipping away from us is we can't remember all the things we're supposed to remember. I'm not this body. Particularly, the good instructions of the spiritual master, what we read this morning, what we heard in class, it all just disappears as soon as, we're too tired. So overworking as well. Overworking is over-endeavour. Rupa Goswami says in the Nectar of Instruction. Over-endeavour is one of the things that destroys devotional service. It affects the intelligence. It affects your Krishna consciousness. It's and of course, on an individual level, devotees should try to regulate their eating, sleeping, etc. in Krishna and working and mating, having children. All of these things. Too much excesses. anything out of proportion will, you know, affect one's intelligence. But also on a managerial platform, devotees should also, if any devotees, I mean most devotees have someone, you know, or a few devotees who work under them. Most devotees have, you know, someone who looks up to them and you know, they're helping them to be engaged in Krishna consciousness or preaching to them. And we should, you know, factor this in, that we have to recognize the level that a person is on, not expect them to jump, you know, reducing your sleep and eating and to that, you know, nice moderate platform is something that you practice and increase bit by bit. It's very hard to just, you know, pounce on that exact, you know, activity right from the beginning. You know, one of the things I've always noticed and sort of a bit of a motto is don't ever expect someone who's not properly trained in Krishna consciousness to just automatically do the right thing in Krishna consciousness. You can almost guarantee they'll do something different. You can almost guarantee it. And you know, the sleeping will be too much, too little, what have you. So it's a matter of allowing for young devotees, new devotees, people we're preaching to, for, you know, in very. I remember when I first spoke to Ramaswamy, and when I came to the temple on the first day, and I asked him, you know, do devotees have cold showers? And you know, questions like this. Oh, no, no, no. You know, so he didn't, you know, no, you know, some do, but, you know, it's not really effective. So he wasn't really expecting that, you know, this is something that I should understand. Yes, if you want to join our movement, you'd be taking cold showers, you'd be sleeping, you know, such and such like that. You know, he would. Strangely enough, the next day I left Ramaswamy's bus, and within about a week I was out in the Nullarbor having, you know, cold bucket baths in the desert about 3:30 in the morning. It's freezing. But there was no other way to take a bath. But of course, you know, when we were at temples and things like that, he didn't expect that we would be taking, you know, cold showers. If there's a hot shower there, you know, then yeah, have a hot shower. If you know, a new person comes to Krishna consciousness, we don't throw a bucket of ice cold water on them. So now you're a devotee. And I did, you know, I told this story also, that one time I was travelling with devotees and some sannyasis, my spiritual master in New Zealand. We were doing padayatra, we were going from town to town and putting on a big festival, and then we moved to another town. And we'd usually stop at a beach or a river. There may have been sometimes some showers, but quite often we'd bathe in the river or what have you, or sometimes warm up a little water. I remember one morning hearing this child, probably a couple of years old, just screaming, a little boy screaming in agony. And I thought, oh, you know, someone's going to go and, you know, tend to that boy. Surely there's like, you know, a couple of hundred people out there. And it didn't stop. So I got up and I went out. And I went over to this, in the footy field. It's freezing cold morning in New Zealand. And here's the father giving this child a cold bucket bath. I couldn't even do it. You know. I've been a devotee for, you know, quite a while, and you know, the kid was screaming. But he was, you know, his understanding is that, you know, if you want to be a devotee, you know, you've got to come to this point at 2 years old, right? So, you know, so sometimes we have unreal expectations, but that moderate tendency and treating each devotee according to their individual capacity will actually present the best opportunity for them and the community to become Krishna conscious. And when there is too much or too little, it actually affects a person's Krishna consciousness. Even one think, oh, we're forcing the austerity on this person and making them engage in so much, it can actually have the opposite effect on a person like that. So this is very nice. So in this way, if we follow this, take advantage of such wonderful wisdom, and this wisdom is like thousands, 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 apparently eternal, ancient, Purana, very, very old. And that knowledge is there. And with all the knowledge, if you gather all the knowledge in the world today about, the workings of the subtle body and interrelating, they have no... they have a little grain of sand compared to this ocean of nectar. But I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments. Yeah. Well, then, by fixing one's mind on Krishna, everything becomes properly situated, the intelligence, the mind, the senses. That is described, that Maharaj Ambarish, he used his mind in this way, he used his intelligence in this way, he used his different senses. And Prabhupada often comments on that, that first of all he fixed his mind on Krishna. Yeah. So when one fixes Krishna, fixing Krishna in one's mind, just like we're doing now, Srimad Bhagavatam, that's Krishna in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna in the form of the holy name, Krishna in the form of the deity, Krishna in the form of the spiritual master, and Krishna's representatives as the Vaishnavas. Fixing Krishna consciousness in one's mind, then everything, the intelligence and the senses and the mind becomes properly situated. Here it mentions in this verse that these are some aspects of the analytical study of intelligence as described in both the Patanjali Yoga system and the Sankhya philosophy system of Kapila and Srimad Bhagavatam. And, we see in the Bhagavad Gita, in verse 60, 61, that sort of area, the second chapter, where Krishna describes that... one of the senses on which the mind focuses will carry away the intelligence even of a person of discrimination. So a person may be following very nicely the Patanjali system or some yogi system and understanding very nicely how to, moderate their activities to keep very clear intelligence, but Krishna still says that without Krishna consciousness, the danger is that one of the senses may carry away that intelligence. And we have the example of was it Vishvamitra, great yogi, meditating in the water for thousands and thousands of years, and saw the fish, copulating. And thought of sex life. Others, Sabarimani, yeah. And, then become, a whole saga happened. Granted, I think he came back to Krishna consciousness. So, therefore, the most important aspect is to, somehow one's mind should be absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And if that is there, as described, I think it's verse 61 of the Bhagavad Gita. Have you got that there? Can you say that loudly? Yeah, 61. So, you know, the practice is there of the senses, you know, obviously under the control of intelligence, you're keeping them in control, and your mind is fixed on Krishna, that person's intelligence remains steady. And as soon as, you know, we're not thinking of Krishna, then even the greatest intelligent minds and yogis and philosophers are at risk. Do you have one? You have one, I'll have one.
What is your opinion?
Cold showers. I used to get sick if I'd have a cold shower. I'm you know, a very thin person. Even in summer, I always take a jumper wherever I go. And, you know, if it cools down, you know, even on a summer's day, I'll put a jumper on. Because I don't have a lot of body weight, and I feel the cold instantly. So I generally don't have cold showers because I get colds like that. So I avoid them. Certain people are different. Others I've seen. Just different type of body, but they seem to, just don't like to have, a lot of clothes because they get hot really easily, and, for them, a cold shower is not particularly disturbing, and it doesn't affect them physically. I mean, if you have a cold shower and it's not going to give you a cold or, not make you ill, and somehow you feel that it wakes you up, then do so, but if it's detrimental... Yeah, so again, this is where it's good to have, so the question is that sometimes we hear something in Krishna consciousness, still the doubts remain, but we sort of just tend to accept it, although we really maintain the doubt. And this is where it's good to have authorities, because when it's coming through authorities like Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam, then what we understand is, Krishna, that, okay, I have a doubt about that. But because it's coming from authority, it means that I accept it and I gradually have to come to the point of understanding. I can't reject that even though I don't understand. The tendency to reject something we don't understand can be dangerous, isn't it? If we say to a child, don't touch that fire, and the child's thinking, it just looks like a lovely coloured orange light just waiting for me to grab a hold of it. So the child rejects it because they don't understand that it's hot. So it's very dangerous to reject something just because you don't understand it. And this is the benefit of that doubt. But there must be the authoritative knowledge as well. And so when it's coming from authority, then we accept it, and then we understand that I somehow have to come to the point where I do understand what that authority is giving at that. Yeah. It's just like, some people who used to come to Krishna consciousness, the fact that they had to bow down, especially for Westerners who just had they'd never seen anything, they'd never even heard of bowing down, touching your head on the ground. In the Western countries, to bow down. You know, it's, what is that? You know, it's like, oh, get on the ground, grovel. What are you talking about? Like, you know, they have no experience of it. And then, you know, understanding, okay, well, there's part of the custom, the tradition, but, you know, I'm not going to do it. You know, I've never done it. I've never seen anyone do it, so I'm just not going to do it. And, you know, there was one particular person, you know, Prabhupada said, just bow down and then you'll understand. You know, just do it. Just bow down and then gradually you'll understand. So, you know, he was presenting to them. So, you know, now at that point, the person either rejects Prabhupada outright or he accepts, well, you're the authority. So if I do it, and I have to wait until the understanding comes to bow down. And it will come if I do it. Otherwise, we just reject Prabhupada and we go away. And as I was saying in the beginning of the class, you know, there are a lot of topics in ISKCON, hot topics, and sometimes we don't understand what Prabhupada, you know, what Prabhupada has made different statements about things. We have to accept that Prabhupada is the authority. Whether we understand it or not, we have to do it and come to the understand and come to the level where we, you know, understand fully, you know, what we're doing. The difficulty is, as I said, that in that point where one is doing something but the understanding is not there, one can do something incorrectly. As we said with the person bathing his child. So he understands Prabhupada wants austerity, Prabhupada wants cleanliness, Prabhupada wants these kids to be trained. So because the understanding is there, he's following without understanding. So therefore, you know, we have authorities from Prabhupada, but we also have authorities, just the devotees you're working with on a daily basis. And you see what the general devotees, especially mature devotees, are doing. You know, one sannyasi once said, the sign of a neophyte, someone basically, is it always too much or too little? A mature devotee, that's not their position. You know, it's not good balance. Someone whose understanding is not there, you can guarantee. You know, not that it may have a guarantee, it'll be too much or too little of whatever they're doing. And therefore, they should associate with the mature devotees who seem to be steady and doing things without too much disturbance in their life. That, okay, how are you doing that? Because obviously you have a better understanding of what Prabhupada means than what I do. If it's too much or too little and causing me so much trouble either way. At that. So it's still, you know, relying on the authorities. And, you know, this is what the disciple course teaches us, that, you know, from the GBC, that the strength of ISKCON is that we have a multitude of authorities. That is its strength, and we should take advantage. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? How is the Archaman, or the Archaman mantras? Oh. That long list of, yeah, the whole, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, here in this section, we get the main principle that Aniruddha, presiding deity of the mind, and if we meditate upon Aniruddha, think of Aniruddha, it helps especially to purify the mind. Was it Pradyumna for the intelligence? And, you know, Vasudeva for the consciousness, Sankarshan for the Vasudeva, like that. And then, you know, there are further expansions of those personalities for other different, just like intelligence, which is under Prajnanam has all these different divisions, doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, you'll find that there's a deity for each of those as well. So, you know, it's, without going too technical, but, you know, the principal deities then have their expansions, and that's what's there within those, you know, the various mantras. Each name, you know, it's a real science. They have a particular portfolio, all those avatars like that, yeah. All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.